Good evening, everyone. I'm Katie Stover, the Director of Reader Services for the Kansas City Public Library. Welcome to the library this evening. I am delighted to be visiting with one of NPR's liveliest correspondents, Aarti Shahani.
Hi. It's nice to meet you. Thank you.
We have all heard Aarti on our local station, KCUR. We should have heard her this morning. She was on Up to Date with Sam Zeff. And maybe you've heard her on KPR. They're based in Lawrence. And her insightful reporting on Silicon Valley and how the tech industry is impacting our everyday lives gives us new ways to think about how we communicate and navigate our ever-changing world. And so let's pause a moment and consider technology, like the cell phone. Aarti brought hers too.
Yeah. Well, mine is already on airplane mode.
So let's all be like Aarti and put our phones on silent or airplane or stun or your preferred setting.
Yeah. That was very well done.
I don't want anyone to miss a word that Aarti has to say. Tonight we get to see the person behind the voice, and Aarti Shahani is here to chat with us about her debut book, a memoir of her family's immigrant experience. Here we are, American Dreams and Nightmares. And thank you for putting Kansas City on your book tour schedule.
Thank you,
Rainy Day, for bringing Aarti to the library.
Thank you.
So I'd like to start with something that Aarti said to me this morning at the radio station. We were talking about her book, and she said, you thought of this book as a coming-of-age story and less an immigrant one. Mm-hmm. So introduce us to your book as a coming-of-age memoir.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because, you know, there's sort of many ways to frame an experience. Stories are ultimately choices about the through line that you're going to pick up to understand what's happened in your life. And part of why I needed to write this book was just to make sense of my life. I grew up an undocumented kid in Queens, New York. Not something you know about me when you hear me on the radio, maybe not something you assume or associate with my voice. I joke on the radio, I'm kind of like Indian IT lady. I bring you all the latest news about Google and Facebook and whatnot. But it became important to me that my public voice reflect more wholly who I am, and that I wasn't, in a way, whitewashing my own past. It felt important to me to share actually where I come from. I started off a kid in Queens without papers. My parents, brother, sister, and I lived in a one-bedroom apartment that our neighbors were awesome. The super sucked. I woke up more than once, I recall, with a roach crawling on my bare skin because it was a real dump. I was still very young when my family got our papers, and I was kind of living my own life. I've always been kind of a nerd, and so I was in public school, sort of that annoying kid who's like, me, like just pick out, you know, whatever, that kid who no one wants to be friends with. I got selected to go into a private school on a full scholarship. It was an amazing experience. From eighth grade public school, where I had 45 students in a class, I went into ninth grade private school, where I walked into Latin class, and I only saw six kids there, including me, and I'm like, where is everyone? And they're like, this is the full class. The school I went to cost, in today's terms, a Tesla a year to attend. I had never seen so many white people in one place in real life before. I grew up in an incredibly diverse neighborhood that I call a working class United Nations. It was a lot of Asia and South America and Africa, a little bit of Europe. So Brearley, my prep school, was my experience, not just to white America, but to hyper elite America. I learned terms like country house. You might not know this word, this term. It is a home that is your second home. Concept blew my mind because of where I grew up. I didn't know that there could be that kind of wealth among so many people. An interesting thing happened when I got to my private school and I was a precocious scholarship kid. I felt deep, profound tension with my parents. I was ashamed of them. And in the sense of, I can give you these little subtle things that started to happen. When I was in public school, when it was parent-teacher day, I wanted mom and dad to come because I wanted them to hear, like, oh, your daughter's a great student. At my prep school, I never wanted my parents to show up because I just felt like people thought they were the help, right? So the other parents would talk to each other about, like, oh, why don't you come vacation with me? Or, you know, come weekend with me, weekend is a verb, or come to my country house, or, you know. And no one talked to my parents, and it was jarring to me because actually my mother, back in Queens, in Flushing where I grew up, was a community leader. She had become the woman who helped clean up our crap building. My parents were not formally educated, but they spoke six languages. So mom would help to mediate conflicts, for example, between the Hindu temple and the Latin American, Central American day laborers speaking Spanish and Hindi to help them understand each other and not hate each other. But in my prep school, I was a high school kid, and I was like, oh no, my parents make me look bad. And it was like a crappy sort of perspective to have about where you come from. But then my dad, in my opinion, did something that really made him look bad. He got himself arrested. And that's where the story, I think, really takes off, is when I was getting, you know, sort of, when I was the scholarship kid, being nerd girl, my father opened a shop, his own store, a small store, on 28th Street and Broadway in Manhattan. And it was a wholesale electronics store on the very same block where he used to shovel snow for $4 an hour. Now, my father was a brilliant man. I mentioned he spoke six languages. He could also multiply very large numbers in his head. He was also a lifelong migrant. He was uprooted from his hometown when he was a child during the end of British colonialism. The British left the Indian subcontinent in quite a messy hurry. They divided up the land. They actually had a person who'd never set foot on the subcontinent divide up the land. And it resulted in the death and or uprooting of millions of people. My father was one of them, and he basically lived his life as a lifelong migrant. And what that means is that he basically never got to matter. Every time he moved from one place to another, through the forces of, frankly, low-end globalization, he just didn't really, you know, who he was effectively irrelevant. His credentials didn't matter. There was no context to understand him and size him up and praise him. Anyway, I didn't really value this guy. The way I'm talking to you about him now is not how I felt about him when I was little. When I was little, I was like, oh, he's just the guy who works 7 days a week. I don't really know him. I can't say I even really like him. He comes home, he smokes Marlboros, and he only talks to me to say that my skirt is too short. You know, that was dad. And maybe you've had a father like that. Maybe you are a father like that. Okay, so let's just acknowledge that this is a very familiar kind of guy. When my father got arrested, here's the context. We get a call. I was, at that point, 16 years old, working at a white-collar law firm in Manhattan. I'd gotten this job through my Brearley teacher, my prep school teacher. It was incredibly impressive to me and my family that I managed to get this kind of job so early in life, and it had everything to do with an elite institution handing me more and more access to more and more things. Anyway, I get the call from my mother. She's crying profusely. My father is in Rikers Island. Rikers Island is an incredibly notorious jail in New York City. It is a place where prisoners are routinely gang raped, beaten, slashed in the face. It is horrific. There are efforts to close it down underway right now. According to New York State, my father, as well as his little brother, my uncle, sold watches and calculators to the wrong guys, to members of the Cali drug cartel. Now, this is in the 90s. If you understand anything, or if you remember anything about the war on drugs, the Cali cartel were horrific people. And according to the state, my family business was basically a drug front, a money laundering front. Now, if you're a young girl or a girl, a teenager, becoming a young woman, already struggling to make your own leaps and fit into places where the social signals tell you your parents don't belong, and you're picking up on that, and then your dad lands himself in jail, and my professional goal when I was a child was to become a prosecutor. That was my aim in life. It was utterly disorienting and formative, and that's where my book really takes off. I explore the profound shame I felt at where I came from and who my father was, and how unexpectedly, over the course of 14 years and then some, that shame shattered, the distance from my father fell apart, and what ended up happening was that I ended up, pretty much because my father was embroiled in a case that was destroying his life, I ended up paying attention to what was happening in that case because many things were going wrong. And in the process, I learned it was my greatest lesson in how the justice system in this country works or doesn't work. And I got to know my father. So in some ways, you know, when I say this is a coming-of-age story, our relationships with our parents are incredibly formative, whether we talk about it or not. Some people's reaction is to pretend it's not. I have many friends who do not really have relationships with their parents, although you always do. You're incredibly tied to each other, whether you acknowledge those bonds or not. And what I'm doing in my book is understanding my own identity through the person, through the man who was most formative in shaping it, both for the things he said to me and the things that he didn't, for the things that happened to him, not to me, and for how I reacted to them. And so, you know, I feel like I became a woman in the context of a case that destroyed my father's life. He was arrested, I told you, and he agreed to an 8-month sentence. They told him, the defense lawyer that we hired, that I helped us to hire, was like, Mr. Shahani, no one here thinks that you're really a Cali cartel ringleader. They're gonna give you 8 months. Serve your 8 months, get it over with, go back to your life. Well, he did what everyone does. He agreed with the plea bargain. Why not? Because if you go to trial, not everyone knows this about the justice system, if you go to trial, you have what's called a trial penalty. So if you're convicted for the exact same offense that you're indicted on, you could face a decade or 15 years. So do you do 8 months or do you gamble? My father actually liked to gamble. I started gambling to bond with him. I talk about that in the book. But he didn't want to gamble with this. It was too big of a gamble. So he took the plea, and the 8-month sentence ended up spiraling into a 14-year legal battle anyway, because after he was done serving his time, the federal government came in to delegalize him and deport him. So I actually, you know, I was 16 when I remember getting that call from mom, when I was at my fancy white-collar law firm trying to fit into a world I already felt I didn't belong in. And I was 30 when the legal problems finally ended. So my life has been pretty defined by it. And then, you know, when you hear me on NPR, it's what you're really hearing is a young woman, not so young anymore, who is basically running away as fast as she could from where she came from. We all have a story.
That sounds a little bit like, that's the nightmare experience. Mm. But you subtitle your book, American Dreams and American Nightmares. Yeah. So where's the dream part for
you? I appreciate you asking. Yeah, because it's not that simple. It would be incorrect of me to just say our life in this country has been or was a nightmare. Because look at my life. Look at what I get to do. I mean, it is not lost on me that I have a life that is frankly full of privilege and access. Unfortunately, my father couldn't be recognized for who he was. I get to be recognized. I get accolades, whatever. It's funny because, you know, I don't think that's the case anymore in America. Part of why I needed to write this book about my own coming of age and my own meditation on this country, that subtitle, American Dreams and American Nightmares, it's my thesis about America, which is that the both coexist. It's a duality. So you have stories where people who come from nothing get to leap into worlds where they don't belong, worlds that they didn't even know existed. And that's actually the nature of the dream. It's that it's like it's something beyond your wildest imagination or only could have been in your imagination, but then it comes to life. That is actually the dream. And then the nightmare is what happens to way too many people in this country that we don't acknowledge because of systems that are structurally highly flawed, that exclude people, that punish the working poor, that punish people of color. All of this is like deeply also part of the American experience. My family experienced the both of it. Part of what I worry about now is I look at, for example, kids coming in. You've all seen pictures of the children at the border? You've seen these pictures? Yeah. Whether they're in cages, whether they're not in cages, whether they're in court, whether they're just there with their families, not separated. Those kids, I look at them with deep identification. I am them and they are me, but for the difference of when we arrived here. If my family came to the US today, I wouldn't have gotten my paper in a handful of years. I would have had to, for the same process we used, it was called a sibling petition. For that same process, the wait would have been 25 years. So I wouldn't have had any access. I wouldn't have been able to step in the world, into the world of the formal and the documented and had the climb. So writing today, as if I were a newcomer today, then the subheading would just be American nightmares. There would be no dreams. And I don't like that. Like, I think that what makes this country beautiful for all the flaws that we have. And listen, I spent a good portion of my life looking for utopia. And it was hard to see that it doesn't exist. But what I believe is that we are capable of being better than we currently are, but we're not so aware of how bad we've let things get. So in part of what I'm doing is, like, I would hope that people in this room identify with me. You have ambitions. Maybe you have kids like me. Maybe you are like me. You have a voice. You want to use it. You know, you're intellectually curious. You want to get things done in the world. And all I've done is layer on to that human experience, that American experience, the fact of being a migrant and how concretely that ends up profoundly upending your life.
Did you feel any change when you got your papers? You mentioned that the family was able to get their green cards, get their papers, and that probably meant something for your mom and your dad.
Huge.
How did it affect you and Deepak and Anji?
Thank you for remembering my siblings' names. That's so good. I was still young. What I remember, these are sort of amazing facts that, you know, we've had, unfortunately, in our nation of immigrants, a tendency to flatten and make two-dimensional the very people we're talking about. Like the newspaper, and I'm part of the media industry, the headlines don't do it justice, and we forget we're talking about real people with real issues. So part of what I'm doing in my memoir is like telling a really honest family story where it's messy. So for example, when we came to this country, my parents had really different reactions to it. My mother, for example, loved the diversity. She loved that everyone spoke a different language and everyone had a different skin color. And she felt liberated from the shackles of what was expected of an Indian wife. A lot of women who have come to America, and maybe it's your story, maybe it's your grandma's or great-grandma's, Ellis Island is full of these stories of women coming here because they wanted to break free from their family. Okay, we don't teach that in AP history class. We teach about the fleeing from communism. We should teach about the fleeing from patriarchy. But, you know, mom was so happy to be liberated. And my father was just reeling from shock. He was like, what have I stepped into? What is this place? I don't understand. And I actually write about that explicitly because I want it to be okay for people to feel uncomfortable with difference, because that's actually part of what we need in this country to eventually fit in with each other. You have to be able to say that you feel uncomfortable, and that's not justification for a mass shooting, okay? But it's okay to acknowledge, and I write very bluntly how uncomfortable my father was. And the interesting thing about the process of getting green cards is before we got green cards, there were certain threats that were external. Like, my mom would always cross the street if NYPD was walking down the block. She just froze and got scared and needed to make sure to remain invisible. But really the greatest harm to us when we didn't have papers were members of our own ethnic community who happened to have their papers and then preyed on us. Like, literally, there's a scene I wrote about in the book where we had a one-bedroom apartment, and in the one bedroom, my mom had a sewing machine at one corner because she was a seamstress, and she was making wedding dresses at home while babysitting us. And my dad had a drawer with a filing cabinet drawer in the same bedroom. Mom opened the filing cabinet drawer one day. She was probably being nosy. She says she was looking for something. She was just being nosy. And she opens it, and she sees a deposited check stub for four figures, maybe it was $1,000, but like an enormous amount for us, made out to a woman of our ethnic community. And my mother immediately assumes, oh my God, my husband is having an affair. And she also has the petty thought of like, and she's not more attractive than me. But, but you know, so mom confronts dad, she, dad comes home and she's like, how can you be giving money to this woman when our children can't even eat meat? You know, because we were choosing what to eat and we had very humble diets back then. And I remember that vividly. Like I remember being a child of 4 and 5 and looking at the cost of a butter roll versus a cream cheese bagel because I knew my parents didn't have money. Like that kind of thing was always there. And a lot of children whose parents don't have, they're aware of these things. But anyway, my father was like, no, I'm not cheating on you. They're bribing us. This couple who was friends of dad's from back home, back in India where he lived there, who happened to be our neighbors in Queens, were like, we'll call the deportation authorities on you. And so that kind of thing created a lot of tension.
That was an infuriating scene for me to read.
And I would say even the man of that couple, at some point my father was actually away and the man visited our home. And actually it's funny, I remember this, my brother remembers this, my mother remembers this. And partly when I was writing this book, my process was I did, forgive the term, a vomit draft. Just push out. I pushed out 4,000 words a day. Push it out, push it out, push it out. And then once I had, a book is a collection of 60 to 80 scenes. So once I had my scenes, then my process was I'm going to give it to my mother, brother, and sister. My father has since passed, okay? So this book, it's kind of funny because it's my coming of age story, and it's also my eulogy for dad. It's the both that coexist. But I gave it to my siblings and mother, the vomit draft, and they read through it. They actually loved it, thank God. And they remembered certain scenes. So there was one time that when we still didn't, you know, when we're still sort of very much at risk in this country and very vulnerable, the husband from that couple that was bribing us came to our home when dad wasn't there and actually tried to fondle my mother. And this is not uncommon stuff. This is super common stuff. These are not unique stories. I mean, part of what I can't emphasize enough is that, like, my story is not unique, not by a long shot, you know? The unique thing is I get to have a platform to tell it. That's the unique part.
That explains why you structured the book in acts with an intermission. Can you tell us why you decided to do that? That's unique. I have not seen that in a memoir.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know when you're trying to make sense of your life, there are certain times where there is just like intensive activity and like a lot is happening. And there are certain periods where there is much less activity. And so I structured the book to kind of organize and make sense of a chronology where there was really about two, I'm recounting in the book, life from being a toddler to being in my 30s. But the book is, you can see it's tiny. And the reason for that, I basically was just trying to organize. There was really a 2 to 3 year period of time of insane, intensive action. So much action happening. My father not just being arrested, but deportation proceedings beginning. My uncle, who was in the case with him, being held instead of 8 months, he was held for 2.5 years because of an administrative error by New York State. I launched myself, me wanting to be the prosecutor. My first foray into law was basically becoming the defender of my family and personally writing to the judge who had overseen that case to get him to intervene. I remember I was a 19-year-old in college writing to the judge, complaining about the legal system. He actually responded immediately and helped us to fix the problems and then other problems happened. During the course of this, there was a huge betrayal that happened. I'm trying to not give away plot for people who want to, you know, read the story with me and experience it as I experienced it. But the deepest betrayals in the book end up coming. The legal system, it's not betrayal from the legal system because it's cold and bureaucratic and impersonal, right? So the kind of justice, if you can call it that, that my family faced, what was painful about it was that we just didn't matter. Who we were didn't matter. The deportation system is such that you could be legal with kids who are American citizens and a first-time nonviolent offense that is even a misdemeanor, and still the laws are such that you will be mandatorily and automatically deported. Those are the laws. And my family was at the front end of this legal regime in the U.S. It started in the 90s under Clinton, not under Trump. And so, you know, the acts are basically, you know, in broad brushstrokes, our backstory of how we got here and being undocumented. And then the little golden period of having made it and how awesome it was. It was so awesome that we moved to suburban New Jersey and bought a 5-foot TV. You know, like that's how good life got. And then the arrest, where things started to spiral slowly. And then the deportation, where things spiraled even more. And in the midst of all of that, there's a deep betrayal that happens that I'm not going to spell out for you. That, you know, when people are going through horrific life situations, they can have really good or really bad reflexes. My father, I told you he was brilliant, he was. He had really bad reflexes about who to trust in life. And it always got him. He was not a good character read. He really was not. And I think it had to do with his own insecurity. You know, he came from nothing. He came from a poor family. He became a migrant worker when he was a teenager, leaving his homeland and leaving his family to begin providing for 13 people back home. And so he was forced to be an adult starting at what, age 18 or 19? And I could see the insecurity that really lingered in him. And so when he was under the gun and his life was falling apart, he kept wanting to trust his own countrymen, and they kept taking him for a ride. So yeah, the acts kind of reflect the different seasons of life. Yeah.
And I'm going to move back a little bit. You phrased the whole system as cold and bureaucratic and mm-hmm. impersonal. And I love how you bookended your story with your visit to the judge mm-hmm. who oversaw your father's case and a visit again to the judge's home after yeah. the judge had retired. And yeah. that's pretty powerful. Did either of those visits change your perception of what happened? Or mm-hmm. it did, but mm-hmm. how broadly did it change it?
Yeah, it was really, it's funny because I begin the book talking about a serendipitous, accidental reunion I had with the judge who hit the gavel against my father. Here's what happened. I'm an NPR reporter. People hear me on air. On LinkedIn, I get a message from the man who ran Rikers Island Jail. We have friends in common. He asks me if I'd like to get together sometime when I'm in New York. He's a chatty man. He's a very smart man, and he likes talking to journalists. I'm like, sure. We get together. We have coffee. He asks me why I'm interested in criminal justice. He knows that I am, and it's part of why we have mutual friends. I tell him, because my father was a prisoner at your jail, at Rikers. And he's like, oh, is that right? Who was the judge? And I'm like, sure, you know. It's like, yeah, the judge is Joel Blumenfeld. I didn't think he was going to know him. He's like, oh, he's my very best friend. They weekend together in their country houses. And he's like, he's a really great guy. Do you want to meet him? And like, he made it sound as casual as a Tinder date. Like, you want to meet the guy? And I'm like, sure, swipe right. And so he emailed me and the judge. The judge responded, inviting me to come to his private chambers. Now, I didn't know why I wanted to go, because I was living my own life. The last act of the book, I talk about the seasons of life, is when my family's legal problems were finally over, I ran away. I was a 30-year-old woman with no discernible career whatsoever to speak of. I'd spent my 20s being an activist in prisons and jails trying to help immigrant prisoners like my dad from being deported, a sort of career path, if you could call it that, that I very accidentally fell into. And by the end of it, I was totally burned out. I was incredibly sad. And my credit score was awful. Like, I had terrible credit. And I had nothing to fall back on. So when I could finally leave home, I just ran away. And I made a hard career pivot into business journalism. So, you know, 20s with prisoners, 30s with tech geeks. It makes sense. So I was in that life. I was basically, you know, it's not dissimilar from being in Brearley, my prep school. You know, when I was in ninth grade, I went into the elite world of upper echelons Manhattan. And when I was 30, 32, I went into the elite world of Silicon Valley. Still, I wanted to see this judge. So I go to his private chambers in Queens. I take the train out there when I'm visiting New York one time for business. Go through the courtroom, go to his chambers. He opens the door. And mind you, kids don't get to go to the chambers of the judges who sentenced their fathers. This is not something that happens, okay? This is very unique. I go, I knock, he opens the door. Before I've come in, before we've sat down, while we're still shaking hands more or less, he says, "Your father and uncle should never have taken that guilty plea. What a mistake."
What a way to open your book. What a hook.
That's.
I was like, okay, we're done. This is what we're doing for the rest of the week.
Well, and this is like the interesting thing, because I think it is the most powerful interview I recount, but it wasn't an interview. I didn't go there seeking information. I was just being curious. I don't know why I went there. I went there, I had an existential need, probably to look the man in the eye who helped, in my opinion, unravel our lives. And it turns out, and I assumed that this man was giving me the time of day because now I'm important. He hears me on the radio. That's why I'm getting this access. What became abundantly clear to me when I was sitting with him in his chambers was he vividly remembered me as a child, he said, and he wanted to see me again because he remembered me writing to him. He remembered my young activism for my family. It had moved him a lot. He told me that he'd gotten that letter from me when my uncle was still inside being wrongfully held and things were falling apart. He'd gotten that letter from me, and he's like, "You were my daughter's age. I was imagining if she had to go through something like this." So, you know, the judge and I have a very complicated relationship. I don't want to tell you how to read it. You can read it for yourself. There are two versions of it. In one version of it, it's clear that we have a complicated relationship, but there is tenderness and mutual respect, which is what I actually think is true. And in another version, I really dislike this man, and I have an axe to grind. You know, you'll decide what you see on the paper. I'm not sure if you have an opinion about.
I understand why you have those two differing feelings for the judge, because I felt a little better at the beginning than I did at the end, when I really wanted to reach to the text. No, you can't act like that.
Yeah, but it was an interesting lesson in trauma.
I got angry.
Yeah, and it was, you know, here's the thing about trauma that I think is very challenging for us is that, and why am I bringing up trauma? I didn't know before that you had to be ready to have a conversation. So when I went to that man's chambers, the judge's chambers, and he said they should never have taken the plea, it's not as though I was like, oh, tell me more. I mean, as a journalist and as a person, I tend to interrogate the hell out of anything I can. But in that instant, I just wanted to run out of his courtroom and not hear anything because it was painful. I felt the spirit leave my body. And when I finally was able to leave his chambers, and I held myself together as much as I could, but I was in a rush to get out of there, the tears that started pouring, I mean, I was heaving all the way back from Queens to Manhattan, just heaving. And I literally was like hunched over like this in the subway seat, and I could feel the life that I was meticulously working to build, I could feel it breaking apart. And my fear, to this day, my fear is that, Arthi, your world is gonna fall apart and you're going to be poor and you're gonna have nothing to fall back on. To this day, it's my fear. It's this thing I constantly feel is the truth about my existence. And we all, by the way, have some version of this. But the thing about trauma, that's when I, only in retrospect, because it took me a few years before I had the wherewithal to call him again and be like, hey, judge, what did you mean by that? and that's a lesson then in, I didn't know that I had been so deeply affected by growing up in the shadow of a legal case. I didn't know that. And I only knew it when this direct interaction with someone who was such as an authority figure in all of that presented itself. And I was like, I can't take this. And so, you know, I think the challenging thing with trauma is that where it is for you is actually an incredibly important space to investigate for yourself, because there are many lessons in it. You will learn a lot from investigating it, But you have to have sufficient security around you in other parts of your life, inside you, to have the courage to investigate it, because revisiting the places that caused you the most harm, you might feel trapped in them again, and that's unbearable.
And that's that also probably revisiting all those places, in addition to being difficult for you, you also had to imagine what was going on with your father, what was going on with your mother.
That's right.
And there's a period in your parents' life where they were not together.
Yeah, that's right.
Where your father pretty much had enough for the U.S. and left.
Yeah, this is kind of a very untold part of the immigrant story.
I found this fascinating. And one of the things you wrote is that there are two features in the U.S. that are devastating for immigrants: isolation and the weather.
Yeah.
But
it's true.
And we here in Kansas City, we feel you.
Yeah.
Tell us why and how did that impact your dad's decision to leave?
Yeah. I mean, America compared to other countries is an incredibly lonely place. I'm not the first person to say this. We don't have, in a lot of other parts of the world, your family is your primary social life, and you convene with them at the end of your day and on the weekends, and you're always together. You're basically in a pack. It gives you meaning. It gives you comfort. It also holds you in a specific position. I think that part of the reason that Americans tend to leap and travel and move and define themselves so much is weaker family ties that hold you and bind you to a place. That's my thesis, and if you guys disagree, everyone's got their own take on our culture and what makes us us. So for my father, being here was unbearably lonely. He worked, I mentioned before getting papers, for $4 an hour shoveling snow. He had not seen snow before. Immigrants who come here don't send dispatches back home about how cold it is and how unbearable it is, because you got to front like everything's great, because you're working to fake it till you make it. So it's very biased, the information that's going to reach back to your family and friends there, because you've got to project the success story. After we got our green cards, they had literally come in the mail, we had the green cards, my father decided to pick up and leave. He didn't want to be in America anymore. He felt it was too hard. By the way, many immigrants have made this choice. This is part of what I think is funny about the immigration debate. It's not as though, oh my God, everyone wants to come here and they're all gonna stay here and they're all gonna overrun it. It's like, no, actually the market regulates a lot of this. It's like a lot of people don't wanna stay here. That's a huge part of the immigrant story. We just don't report on it. Ellis Island Archives can confirm that for you as well. That's not just today, it's been historically true. So Dad left. And the reason he came back, I mean, this is a bit of a spoiler, but I can share it with you. It's early on in the book. He left for the Middle East because, he had a huge family, and his brothers had by then migrated to different countries and were working in different countries. He went to the Middle East to live in Dubai, which was at that point a sort of sandy, dusty, empty town. It is not, the skyscrapers and indoor skiing resorts that it is now. It's a very weird place right now. It's like if a piece of land could have plastic surgery, it's Dubai. That's what it is now. But anyway, Dad left. Mom refused to leave. She's like, I'm never going to leave. And that has a lot to do with why we first came to this country. We came to this country because my mother was really severely abused by my dad's mom and his brothers. And so she didn't want to live in a joint family anymore. He missed the comfort of a joint family.
Really quick aside, I love your mom, and I love that she left Morocco.
Yeah, no.
Like, yeah.
She's
something else.
She's a resilient lady, and she's funny. I can actually, I'll finish this dad basically left, and then the reason he came back is one day mom was running to the grocery store to get groceries for us, and she jaywalks. Every New Yorker jaywalks. She jaywalked. Shortest distance between two points is a diagonal. And as she's running across the street looking at her shopping list, figuring out what she can afford on the list, a car hits her and takes off. And she's left paralyzed. And so my aunt, her little sister who had sponsored us for our green cards, called my dad. And she's like, your family is not going to survive without you. Please come back home. please come here. And to my father, who missed us terribly. And my parents loved each other. I mean, they fought like cats and dogs, but they loved each other. He relented, he came back. And so part of the guilt we all had when he ended up having the legal problems, when he ended up being slammed in the system, when he ended up at Rikers Island, part of the guilt we all had was, of the five of us, he was the one who didn't want to stay. And then that's what he was up against. Now, in a very different emotional tenor, a funny story about my mom and parenting. I mean, she's a very resourceful woman. When she was, before the car accident, when she was being a seamstress, she hustled so she could get her boss to let her sew from home, and, as opposed to going into the factory. So she was sewing from home. She was babysitting us. She was cooking. She was cleaning. She was community organizing in the building. She was doing everything. And to save time, I recount this in the book, this is a parenting tip. My sister is only 1 year older than me. She put us on the toilet at the same time, back to back. And we had to do number one and number two and police each other to make sure we were both done. And only when we were both done with doing each of these, we would call mom. She would come to wipe us. Mm-hmm. We weren't allowed to call her until we were both done. And that was efficiency for her because she didn't have the time to take care of two little kids, so kind of put them in unison. And it taught us patience. It was character building. So, you know, there are parenting tips in this coming of age story.
Yes, that was funny. And I could just see little gears running in both of your heads. Yeah. When you realize, oh gosh, mom really is going to walk in here.
Yeah.
We don't want that.
No, she's very strict. She's a very strict woman. Yeah.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit. And Americans have a general notion of what freedom is. Mm. But what did it mean for your parents or for Deepak and Anji and you?
You know, I think my mom has the clearest vision of all of us about freedom and what American freedom means, because she didn't have it until she got to this country. And so you'd even ask me about the sort of the subtitle, why do I say American dreams, not just American nightmares? It's because my mother reminds me how lucky I am to be a girl and a woman raised in America as opposed to back home. So freedom, back home, my sister and I, Ange and I, the expectation would have been, we don't want you too educated because then you're not marriageable. You should be in the kitchen. You should learn cooking and cleaning. We should marry you early and soon while you're still fertile. And that's a fulfilling life. And then you should not cause too many problems with your husband. The notion that a girl or a woman could make money by talking doesn't exist, you know. And in America, what my mom saw, I feel like my mom's entry into America was not dissimilar from my entry into my prep school. There are these parallel things happening for each of us in different moments. But basically, she is seeing the permission girls and women have to have identities outside of wife and caretaker and mother. She was seeing that there's permission in this country she could not have believed existed. She saw it on TV. Part of why she was so determined to come to America is because she saw it on TV. She was like, this is amazing. Hollywood did a lot to shape her understanding of what freedom is. And so in my journey, something I also observe, you know, there's this constant tension between me and my mom in the book. We're incredibly close. We continue to be incredibly close. Growing up with her, been incredibly close to her, I also have a lot of resentment toward her. The resentment of, why is she always oversharing? Why is she always telling me about her problems? When my father was arrested, she told me one day in the kitchen, he says he wants to kill himself. And all I could think to myself is, lady, can you keep anything to yourself? Why do you have to tell me all of your problems? That was my feeling. But there was also a feeling of deep love for her and admiration. I don't know anyone as strong as her. Because to come here and to choose to live undocumented because you know your alternative is living in an incredibly abusive household, this is the straw that broke the camel's back, by the way. My mother, the most resilient woman I knew, she told me in the process of writing this book, because the book is also working through parental resentment, okay? You don't forgive and forget. Actually, I think that it works that you forgive and remember. That if you can kind of make sense of things and piece together what's happened, it gives you peace, right? Whereas if you can't piece together what's happened, that's often why it's constantly rattling in there. So I needed to make sense of things. So one of my questions for Mom was, Mom, I don't get it. Because I didn't know about the extensive abuse back home. I had no clue about any of this. So I was like, you keep saying we came here for a better life for you kids. Well, we had a really crappy life. It sucked. It was really hard. Why would you have chosen with Dad to cross an ocean and live without papers while raising three little kids with no financial stability, no plan, anything like that? You were just winging it. And that's when she told me certain details about this abusive situation. You know, for example, my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, if Mom gave her something she didn't like to eat, she would throw the plate at her, and Mom would duck. Mom wasn't allowed to open the refrigerator without permission. Incredibly embarrassingly, and I recount this in the book, my mother and father were not allowed to sleep in the same room. My grandmother ordered her son, my dad, to sleep in the room with her, and my mom had to sleep in the living room. This went on for years. When I was born, my parents brought me home from the hospital, and this was the breaking point for them. They brought me home from the hospital. My grandmother wouldn't allow my mom and me in the house because I was a girl. So my grandmother said, what have you brought me, another goddamn daughter? What am I going to do with this? And that's when my first night home wasn't even at home. I was taken to a friend's home of my parents. And that's when my father agreed to come to this country, because he saw, as much as he wanted to have his family together, I mean, I told you he left home very young so that he could support his family. He basically spent his life just wanting to have his family together and not being allowed to have that, but for circumstances.
We'll do one more question, and then I'm sure the audience has some questions for you as well.
Yeah.
Am
I supposed to do a small reading? I don't have to.
You don't want to. Yeah. We want to hear from you.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Uh-huh. And if you have a question, audience folks, just speak clearly, and Arti and I will try to our best to repeat it. But I'm borrowing a question that I heard you answer on the radio this morning. So has this book changed or enhanced your relationship with your father? Mm-hmm. And what about the rest of your family?
Yeah. So with Dad, you know, it's funny because it's like I mentioned that this book is a eulogy for him too. He is somebody who mattered a lot to me but didn't get to matter. Now, I can point out that that's a lot of people in low-end globalization. They live extraordinary lives but are structurally irrelevant. I needed to celebrate who he was. I needed to feel connected to who he was. And it's abundantly clear to me that he's inside me. You know, it's abundantly clear to me. And that's, you know, I ask in the book, you know, what is the word for memories you have that are not your own? Because a lot of what happened in the writing of this book, like I could literally see blood soaking the streets of Karachi when my father was a six-year-old fleeing for his life. I could literally see him at Rikers Island, you know, sort of not sure if he might get, you know, slashed and killed that night. Like, they're not my memories, and they're not even things he talked to me about, because he wasn't a hyperverbal person like I am. He was much more introverted, much more quiet, much more closed. He squarely falls into that sense of the people who deal with trauma and tragedy by trying to ignore it. So he's in me, and his memories are mine, even if they're not, you know. Now, with my siblings and my mom, there's an interesting thing about Indian communities in particular that I reflected on while beginning to give these talks. There is a stereotype in this country about who Indian Americans are. Oh, they're all doctors and lawyers. They're model minority perfect. The fact of rampant domestic violence in our community, rampant, is not something that's well understood to our friends and neighbors. We keep it inside. The fact of a lot of betrayal in business and a lot of sort of these kinds of things. Every Indian American knows these stories. It's just not what we talk about. Now, because my family, upon my father's arrest, had been rejected so summarily and so thoroughly by members of our own ethnic community, and we found actually acceptance, love, support from Americans, from other Americans, from people who were here from either from other countries or people who were here a generation or two and kind of understood things. That gave, I think, me and my mom and my brother and my sister a great deal of liberation from the expectations of silence. We didn't have that. So when they saw our story as told through the, you know, the alpha female youngest daughter on the page, I don't think I'm overstating it. They loved it. Because, you know, my sister, who's my toughest critic, her feedback was, we actually sound like us. Well, good. And part of what she meant by that, by the way, is like, you'll see, I have a lot of dialogue in the book. And my big brother, who's about a decade older than me, he's always calling me stupid. Hey, stupid, I told you stupid not to do that. So it's like we also literally just sound like us in terms of how we talk as a family. So yeah, no, I mean, we're in it together.
I think we do want to hear you read a piece.
I can do it quick.
I want to hear their voices and your voice.
Well, you know, the piece that I had in mind is actually a time that I visited my dad in jail, and I actually got to know who he was during that process. I had stopped going to college, and because I wanted to be close to my father while he was serving his sentence, because I was afraid of losing him. So here's a quick scene of that gives you a sense of both him and me. It took 3 hours to get to the last checkpoint, the open-air gym with the tiny tables. There was one woman standing in line in front of me, and she had enormous breasts. I could see a third of them heaving from her V-neck. Oh my goodness, I hope I recognize him, she turned back and told me. Huh? I didn't understand. My girlfriend set me up. I can't tell which one he is. You haven't met before? Nah, but he's going to be out soon. This woman was at Rikers Island on a first date. A blind first date. I wanted to shake her. Girl, I love a captive audience too, but this is taking it too far. Wait till he's out. Good luck, were the words I managed to mouth. A corrections officer pointed to the tiny table where she would meet her man, no guesswork required, and then pointed me to Dad. You look tired, my doll, he said as we sat down. No, I'm good. Are you eating enough? Yeah, Dad, I'm eating plenty. That question got on my nerves. Mom, who was still vomiting multiple times a day, there was a lot of guilt in her, would ask me at 2. And sensing my irritation, she'd latch on, persisting either as martyr mom, Arthi, I ask because I'm your mother, or as infomercial mom, I have homeopathic pills, try them. Dad had the sense to back off. I gave him the London debrief, ending with how Ange went missing. He laughed a deep laugh. That daughter of his could brighten any day. She was so different from him and me that way, a constant reminder of how good it could be if you just let loose sometimes. A few tables over, an inmate sprung from a steel chair and threw it against the wall. Guards raced over and pinned his face and shoulders down. I thought they were about to call off visitation for everyone. They didn't. They just dragged him away. You're not where you thought you'd be, huh? I said to Dad. He shook his head. No, not at all, he said without saying. The silence lingered for a moment. Conversation did not come naturally, inside jail, outside. It always took effort with us. How'd you learn Arabic? I decided to try the interview approach. Did you have books? Tapes? No, I learned by attending the customers, he said. Each day I listened for the important words. Slowly, slowly, I picked up very good Arabic. Important words like what? Kaif halikum, barak alafik, arak lahikan, ana ahabuk habibti. How are you? God bless you. See you. You are my love. That last one stood out. Who taught you that? I asked. There's no way Dad's boss taught it to him. It's a funny thing. You make me go back so many years. He smiled and hesitated for a moment. It was an Armenian girl. She asked me for a date. She said in Arabic as well as in Armenian, Ana Abuka, I love you. Did you say it back to her? I was nervous. I was shocked. I never had a girlfriend. I never went out with anybody. It was strange for me to hear someone say that. But we did go to see a movie. It was In the Heat of the Night. That was the Sidney Poitier film, where an African-American detective goes to the Deep South and gets wrongfully arrested for the murder of a white businessman. Dad was a 25-year-old migrant worker out with an Armenian flight attendant watching a movie about American race relations. My first date was Boys in the Hood. I was in seventh grade, out with a Chinese-American boy who won my heart because he could name every highway that crossed through Queens. Neither Dad nor I were allowed to date. I didn't mention these parallels. He continued, "In the theater, I came to know she spoke English, too. I didn't know that before. We came out of the theater. We spoke English, French, Arabic. It was nice. I began to imagine what she looked like in the dark. If Dad turned to see her profile or just stared straight ahead the whole time. If their fingers or forearms brushed as they strolled the beach after the movie. If they listened to the waves lap or if she found conversation with him more easily than I did. They met when she came to the tourist trap where he worked. She bought leather sandals and brass vases, little trinkets for family and friends. She came back again and again. Then one day she asked him if he had time to go for coffee. At that time, I didn't have permission. The bosses were strict. On some Sundays, I was allowed to leave. So we went for coffee a few times, but the cinema was just once. Why not more? I asked. You love movies. Because I couldn't afford it. She was spending money all the time. I didn't like that. I had limited pocket expenses. I had to think of my family first. When I went back to India, she wrote me a letter. She said, I'm waiting for you. And she sent me a photo. She told me, show to your family. Did you? I asked. Yes, I showed them. My mother, brothers, sisters. They said, who's that girl? Are you taking up the foreign way? Having a girlfriend? Dad shrugged. I didn't much bother about it because I knew I wouldn't be able to and also take care of my family. I see. I began to paraphrase, because you knew if you were going to pursue a relationship, you couldn't send as much money back home, so you either could have a girlfriend or be a good son. Yes, that's true. I felt sorry for young Dad and this Armenian romantic who thought love could transcend distance. Dad hadn't answered my question, which I repeated. Okay, so then did you tell her I love you back? No, I didn't say anything. He laughed at himself. I was nervous and just smiling and putting my head down like a girl. I'm sorry to say, but a fact is a fact. Time's up, a guard called out to us. Time never flies with Dad. This was a first. As I boarded the white bus that went back to the visitor center, the woman who'd had her blind date slipped onto the bench beside me. How'd it go? I felt obligated to ask her. Really well. She smiled ear to ear. We're gonna see each other again. That's great, I feigned approval. Yes, I was judging her, though the uncanny resemblance was not lost on me. She was at Rikers, getting to know a stranger, so was I.
Arthur, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your time and of your fascinating story with us. Are you ready for some audience remarks and questions?
Yeah. Sure. The dead time, I don't know what you're talking about. No, we were in different rooms. I was in California and he was in D.C. Oh. Yeah. And actually what he told me, I didn't know this about, so Steve Inskeep is a colleague of mine. He was actually choking up. So I'm not solely to blame for the dead time. Yeah, so it wasn't, the thing is, my real adjustment to an elite academic institution happened in ninth grade. Like, the leap I made from eighth grade to ninth grade, from public school to private school, was the biggest culture shock of my life. My journey to the University of Chicago and going there was the first time I was a real distance from my family geographically. And so at the beginning, because the legal case was unfolding while I was in school, but at the beginning, I just kind of threw myself into life on campus. You know, I was like, now no one can tell me not to go out and party. And, you know, like, I was just being a kid. And then I was always like a nerd, so, you know, I really took to I mean, I was just sort of all over the social sciences and enjoying that part of academic life. I would say that where I grew up in Queens, similarly to certain neighborhoods in Chicago, is incredibly diverse. And I view that, and I'm sort of curious if people see this differently or the same, but I actually view the diversity as being the DNA of America, not the exception. And so whether you're talking about very different European migrants from a couple of generations ago, or whether you're talking about now more like Asian, African, Latin American migrants, this country is, it's constantly new people coming in and being absorbed into the culture. To me, the single strongest evidence of this is wherever I go in the US, I open Google Maps, I look for restaurants, and 15 ethnicities pop out at me, you know. But yeah, Chicago reminded me of home, certain neighborhoods of Chicago in that respect. Yeah.
Oh, okay, absolutely.
I'll start with favorite podcast that is not NPR. I am very addicted to Ezra Klein's show. The Ezra Klein show. I like his long-form interviews. He's somebody I know, and I have told him this, that so I love his long form. I do think it could often afford to be 20 minutes shorter. but, you know, the fact is he is an interviewer who is incredibly smart and also empathetic, and I like that combination, and I think that he has a real eye for bringing a wide readership into very nuanced public policy conversations. So I love that about his show. A favorite piece of fiction. You know, I'm actually just thinking about Zadie Smith. What's the name of the book that she wrote about the family where it was like the West Indian mother and the British father and the...
White Teeth?
No, it's not White Teeth. No. I want to get the name of that specifically for a reason. It's not White Teeth. It's a very simple name that I'm just having a very hard time remembering right now. But in Zadie Smith's book, I can move my phone off of airplane mode and tell you in a sec. She has a great sense of humor. Okay. And I like to laugh when I'm reading. Part of what was really important to me in recounting what is in some ways a tragedy, right? Like there's a lot of things that I feel my family went through that are sad. In real life, part of what got me through it and part of what gets a lot of people through it is you actually laugh at a lot of things. You know, like I can recall, for example, there was this one moment of a short-term victory I managed to secure for my father when I decided to roll up my sleeves and dive into his case. We got an amazing short-term victory. My father was released from an immigrant prison, a detention center. My sister and I go to pick him up. He looks at us. He can't believe we're hugging on U.S. soil. We didn't think we were going to have that together. He says, "Arthi, my doll, it is amazing the miracle. It is amazing what you've done because I got him out of the federal clutches." And then he looks at my sister, "And Anjali, my doll, you've lost weight. Miracles are happening." And like, you know, life's funny. You know, and so Zadie Smith, I think, has a great sense of humor. So I consume her like crazy.
Oh, it's such a, I love the question. It's a very simple answer. I would have the laws reflect our culture as opposed to our fears. It's just that simple. So there's a truth about American culture versus where the laws have gone. The laws, and I trace this in my memoir, have become more and more restrictive over the decades. My family was at the front end of what President Clinton had done is he actually really, more than any other living modern president, he codified immigration as a problem to be solved through crime control. That was his legacy, and it was a really toxic legacy. It's played out in a lot of different contexts very badly. That's my take on it, my informed take on it. Some of what you see going on at the border right now, like you have women who are fleeing horrific violence, who are living in tent encampments. They're not allowed to come onto US soil and apply for asylum. They're being forced to camp out on the banks of the Rio Grande with their children. And volunteer lawyers are walking the footbridge from Brownsville, Texas to Matamoros, Mexico, to the tent encampments to do intake in the open air with women recounting gang rape. So that's what our legal system looks like right now. It's horrific. our culture is absorbent. We actually, for all we talk right now about tribalism and racial tensions and all that's, listen, it's real. But what's also real is that relative to other countries, we actually handle difference remarkably well. Our levels of intermarriage are off the charts. People are constantly mixing. My mom reminds me of this. She's like, you know, when my parents were fleeing the subcontinent, the Indian subcontinent, their homeland, Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs, three different kinds of Indians, literally were skewering each other's babies alive. That happened in partition. They were burning train cars full of people so that bodies would arrive roasted and dead into the stations. It was horrific violence. Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs in Flushing, Queens, neighbors babysitting for each other, sharing milk and sugar, and killing the roaches together. That's a powerful thing about America. It can really neutralize difference. And so if our culture, if our legal system could, for example, create real lines for people to stand on, there are no effective lines anymore for people to stand on, create real lines. Consider the health of a family before you toss out a parent. Understand migration is actually a working class issue, because it is. The people who are seeking to cross borders, I mean, America is at the forefront of a global trend that is only going to grow more and more and more, not less and less and less. And so if we can understand that trend and then build on the culture we already have, I think it's that simple. But then we just need political leaders that have courage.
Well, folks, please pick up a copy of the book from our friends at Rainy Day. Artie will be happy to sign your copy, and she'll chat for a moment if you didn't get to ask your question during the Q&A. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Artie.
Thank you.
See you on the radio.
Yeah, that's see me on the radio. I love that. See me on the radio. Thank you.